Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, we head over to New York to chat with beverage director and managing partner at one of the city's best new bars, Libertine. That's right, we're sitting down with Cody Pruitt. We chat with him about his love for the city, him coming up in the food scene and how it played a big role for him in his childhood, and what it means to open up a spot for people to hang and relax in one of the greatest cities in the world. And then it's a dip into the archives where Champion Chills, a.k.a. Jimmy Joloff, stopped by to share some of his latest tracks. He chats about the importance of allyship, leveraging his privilege to provide opportunity, and most importantly, keeping everyone's ears and hearts open for discussion and education. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush. I know a man who walks in my neighborhood. He made beautiful songs, but he never sold much, sold much. Came too long after the gold rush. Then he fell in with people you don't trust. Now he can't pay for his own lunch. But I don't judge, don't judge. At the cafe where I practice my Spanish, she asked me if I had an acne can manage. My mom's name is Janice. She's not why I'm manic. I'm good with a secret. I'm not naming names. But give me 10 minutes and things may have changed. California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush. Hand gripping the wheel on the freeway, young enough to sell, old enough to repay. Last minute flight was a couple hundred each way. I got a memory that's starring you, I need to replay. I heard you got a new main thing. I heard he shuffles but he can't swing. The kind of guy to wear shorts to a funeral. But I'ma stay composed like a movie cue. Under the surface I'm batshit bananas. All last minute chances and flashes of panic. Don't judge, don't judge. Not too often I say what I really want much. But California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush.
Cody, welcome to Snacky Tunes. So good to have you. And thanks for doing the good service of having a nice cozy spot for people to enjoy this winter.
Appreciate it. Yeah. I'm glad everyone else seems to appreciate Libertine. It was in my head for a long time and I'm happy to see it and come to fruition now.
No, it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, obviously you grew up in New York and there's been so many changes in the city especially in the last few years, but you're still there. You're still investing in the city, being part of the community. What hasn't changed about New York that you still love about it?
Oh, man. I find the majority of the changes have been fairly tactile and physical, like places have changed, but the overall on the dining scene, the hunger for either creativity or more homier cooking has never been greater. Mm-hmm. As someone who grew up in Hell's Kitchen, and my parents, while they tried to cook and they cooked occasionally, they were not avid cooks. My mom does not love to cook. Mm-hmm. So my exposure to dining out early on and ordering in as well, I think it's only been paralleled with our guests now who appreciate dining experiences.
No, I mean, I know that your parents may have not been lovers of cooking, but they did love to travel. And I know that you went with them around the world, especially to France as a kid. What brought them out of New York and into the great wide unknown, especially bringing kids along years ago?
My mom in particular, she spent, I think a year or two, in England when she was in high school or late middle school. My grandfather was a professor and a teacher, and he was in a teacher exchange program. So they dragged the entire family over, I think in the late 60s, over to England, and they lived there for a while, went to school there. And on weekends, my two uncles, who were younger than my mom, they had soccer practice and whatever else, chess club. And my grandfather had to grade papers, so he kind of politely ushered my grandma and my mom out of the house, and they took the opportunity to cross the pond over to France and kind of traveled extensively through that. My grandparents were both big antique collectors, so that kind of fueled a lot of it. My mom grew up speaking French because my mom's mom, my grandmother, she spoke French. We had a French aunt who was, my great aunt. She was part of the French Resistance, and
wow,
yeah. So we've always had a strong tie to France, to England as well. But for my mom and my grandmother, they discovered a tiny little town in kind of Chablis country, called Vézelay or Saint-Père-sur-Vézelay. And my mom kind of vowed that if she ever had kids, she would bring them back there as well. Mm. And she made good on that. Brought my little brother and I back there, and we spent a lot of summers and like elongated summers at that in France and that region, as well as in Normandy and a little bit of time in Paris, but predominantly kind of Burgundy and north of that, in the Jura and everything like that.
I gotta imagine that food was a big part of these adventures as well.
Massively so. I there are probably more photos of me and my little brother with food all over our faces in a random like little auberge in the middle of nowhere in France than there are of us just like kind of cheesing for the camera. I think every single meal I had in France had some form of pâté because that's all I wanted to eat when I was little.
Countryside as well, right?
Exactly, yeah. My little brother was whisked away because he was very small earlier on, was whisked away usually by a server or the wife of the innkeeper, and he came back covered in chocolate mousse. And we chased chickens and harvested eggs, and it was a very idyllic form of vacation for us. The majority of my friends in school in New York, they were going to Disney World, or they're going to summer camp, or they're going to Jamaica or somewhere else with a beach. I don't think I saw a palm tree until I was like 16.
Fair.
I hated it at the time.
You had the reverse of kids who just want white bread, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yeah. Oh. My mom would not allow white bread and that into our house, whether it be in France or England or here in New York.
Just country loaves and cultured butter, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Large amounts of both. I really resented it for a long time just because I never got to go to Disney World, all these other places. But now it's kind of shaped and formed how I pay my rent and what my passion is and what gets me excited.
Well, speaking of passion, I know that food was a big part of your childhood, but music was also as well, to the point where you studied it. Did they go hand in hand? Were you just listening to old French records while you're out in the countryside, or was it more of a New York endeavor?
The music thing really started for me here in the States. My uncle went to Berklee College of Music, and he played in bands and is absolutely phenomenal singer and guitar player and writer right now. But he ended up opening his own homemade ice cream parlor right like 45 minutes outside of Boston. Mm. And when I was a teenager, I helped him build that. And that was my first kind of exposure to hands-on entrepreneurship. The music thing, he gave me my first guitar when I was six, and I still have it somewhere around here. and I picked it up and tooled around with it a little bit, but I didn't get serious about it until I was 11 or 12. And I'm a very obsessive person, and I kind of put the blinders up when I'm interested in one thing. To a fault sometimes, but in the case of guitar playing, I would come home from school and I wouldn't go on play dates or I wouldn't hang out with anyone else really for a long time. And I would practice 4, 5, 6 hours a day. I used whatever little money I had to buy recording software and kind of taught myself that. There was not much coverage of that on YouTube at the time. This was in the late 90s, I guess. And just kind of taught myself recording through books, and I never liked playing other people's songs. So once I got tired of practicing scales to a metronome and trying to be Steve Vai or someone else, Frank Gambale or someone, I decided to try writing my own stuff, and it became very natural to do so because I already was tooling around with recording. And then I was lucky enough to – my parents are both actors, so we grew up in a building that was subsidized housing for actors, artists, and musicians. Mm. So we were always surrounded by music growing up. And there was actually an amazing recording studio that primarily did Broadway shows, but a lot of pop albums as well and a lot of mixing gigs in the basement of my building. And it had a phenomenal SSL console and everything like that. And it's not around anymore. It hasn't been around for well over a decade. But my summer job was kind of putting away cables and microphones there. Hmm. And then in any downtime, I had keys to the studio. So I was able to bring in my own band or bring in my friends' bands and kind of tool around with it without cost.
That's awesome.
Which was indelibly useful and informative for me. I wanted to make more money, but stay doing recording stuff in early high school. And a friend of mine, a friend of the family, was an executive at Ogilvy & Mather, the advertising firm in Midtown. It's only a few blocks away from where I grew up. So at that point, then I ended up recording and mixing demo trailers as well as actual movie or TV trailers and commercials alongside people who were four times my age, if not more so.
That's so amazing.
Then I kind of jumped around recording studios in Midtown for a while where there still were recording studios for a little bit.
Of course.
At least. My dad's apartment was across the street from Sound on Sound, and we were around the corner from Hit Factory and Avatar and all these amazing, amazing legendary studios. And I was able to intern and get my own time in them. I was playing in bands on weekends and was able to use some free studio time here and there, and ended up doing a bunch of session work on kind of theatrical show albums, as well as some pop stuff, a lot of pop stuff. and then I went to Stuyvesant High School. I was one of the very few kids who wanted to go into popular music or contemporary music there or any music there.
Sure.
It's a math and science school. I ended up going to NYU in the Clive Davis Department of Recorded Music. At the time, I don't know, I think I was the second or third year. I think it was the third year there. Downloading was really, really ramping up. It had already been ramping up. Mm. And my dream of being a mix engineer or songwriter or ghostwriter or a session player and really loving the bigger studio experience through either downloading, drying up budgets, or the ability to record at home, I was fairly short-sighted in pulling the plug on it, but I needed to make money, and I was no longer making much money in music, and that had paid for my life, even through high school. before. So I ended up getting a job at a really crappy but amazingly fun like Asian dive bar restaurant in the East Village. It was like an NYU spot with $4 mixed drinks poured insanely strong.
Do you want to shout it out or let it go to the history of time?
Oh, it was called Asian Pub. There's a different iteration of it now, but
sure.
Yeah, it was $4, $3 mixed drinks served in pine glasses with bubble tea straws.
Love it.
And we got paid all in cash, and it was the most amount of cash I had ever handled every single night. And I was living in the East Village, and then I ended up, by virtue of where I was living in the East Village and the time I was living over there, in like 2006, 2007, 2008, I was living in the East Village in Greenwich Village and Nolita. And then later on Wall Street. But when I was in the East Village, I was surrounded by the cocktail resurgence. Mm-hmm. And I got really excited about
Death
that.
Death & Co. and all those spots.
Yeah, I literally lived in between Death & Co. and PDT. Hmm. And from a bar called The Beagle.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to know those bartenders and kind of culled as much knowledge as I could. A bunch of my friends were working at Milk & Honey or a few of other Sasha Petrosky's bars. Sasha owned very briefly owned a coffee shop that he wanted to turn to a wine bar at nighttime, but the community board wouldn't let him.
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, called the Mercury Dime.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing scene for me because he lived upstairs on the second floor. And it was me and a couple friends who are now fairly influential in the industry and who I went to school with and worked with. And we were all studying our psalm books and our cocktail books and our food books. And Sasha would come downstairs in a tank top with suspenders and slacks on and hauling his laundry down. And we could ask him a question or two. And his high school friend TJ was the barista, and TJ worked at Milk & Honey and created a lot of modern day cocktail lexicon classics. And I'm still friends with him. I still see TJ around and my other friends who were in that kind of informal study group. But I ended up working in fine dining, ended up working in hotels in various capacities, thought I was going to be a cook for a second, but absolutely fucking hated it.
Sort of as a nod to your parents, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I really, really, really love cooking. I started collecting cookbooks when I was like 18.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have about 450, 500 of them. Love cooking at home. There was a Valentine's Day when I was 22 or 23 where I cooked a 4-course meal directly out of the French Laundry cookbook for my girlfriend at the time. So essentially, long story short, did fine dining, did hotel stuff, and then kind of fell into nightclubs. And I worked at nightclubs in various capacities as a promoter for the longest period of time, but as a DJ booker. My business partner in promotion and I formed an events company. We did a bunch of really cool corporate events and did some DJ bookings for other venues and made some phenomenal connections and essentially partied professionally for the better part of a decade.
Sounds good.
Nice. Yeah, it wasn't bad. My mom called it professionally popular. I thought that was the case, but there was also a lot of substances around. And once I got rid of those extra substances beyond the simple wine and spirits, I realized how much I didn't like it. And luckily I had been offered equity in a brand new restaurant called Harding's, which is still open now on 21st Street between Park and Broadway. I had been offered equity because I have my contacts with celebrities and
sure.
people, thanks to the nightlife thing. And I ended up leaving nightlife to go work at Harding's and kind of get my chops there. While I was at NYU a few years prior, once I discovered that I was not going to be in music, I continued my degree, but I used all of my elective credit through NYU to work in the food studies department and the hospitality and hotel management program.
That's so pretty amazing.
I had never really used that side of my education before, and no one in nightclubs knew that I was a certified SOM. No one knew that I could bartend. A couple bartenders at clubs found out about it pretty quickly because I would ask them random weird nerdy questions, and then the sound technician would also find out that I was a former mix engineer when I started asking them questions and
right
further connection with these people. And then, yeah, so I ended up opening a mezcal bar with the same people behind Harding's, the final 3 years of a very undermarket lease in a space right next door to Gramercy Tavern, and ran that for a bit, then ended up working for larger companies. I ran the beverage program for a place called Union Fair, which was like 28,000 square foot.
Wow.
Concept venue in the entire original Barnes & Noble space. Union Square.
Yeah. And
learned a lot about what I didn't like doing, but made good money there. Then I did a bunch of consulting. I really missed working with wine, and I had been sitting on this concept of doing a natural wine centric French bistro in New York for a long time. Like 8-9 years ago at this point. Found partners, looked at spaces, made offers, raised money, didn't work, had to return the money time and time again. And then eventually the night before Thanksgiving in 2018. And I was like, I guess I got to get a regular job. Consulting's fine, but I need some consistency in my life.
No, I hear you.
And I went on to Craigslist. A bunch of headhunters had hit me up, but I went on to Craigslist and typed in natural wine into the job category. And the first thing that popped up was Anfora West Village Natural Wine Cocktail Bar, looking for GM and beverage director, and thought that was pretty perfect, considering my focus in natural wine and my background with cocktails, my background as an operator already. They said it was highly autonomous and everything. It kind of needs to be a self-starter. Really, you're doing your own thing. The program's yours. So I applied for that, made fast friends with the ownership there. And I started 2 weeks before they closed the restaurant next door to Anfora. They closed Del Anima, which has since moved to another location. But Anfora, up until then, was always just kind of a feeder bar for Del Anima.
Right.
But with Del Anima closing, it really needed to stand on its own 2 feet. The previous GMs or buyers there, they weren't necessarily operators, or they were somms, or they were cocktail people. They weren't kind of all three.
Right.
They needed someone to be able to run it. Like, I don't think Anfora had ever bought toilet paper through a distributor themselves, because they always just took some from Del Anima, and almost the food prep was over there. So I ended up putting my own recipes in for all the food, doing all the food buying and curating. Took over the wine program. I gutted it and made it my own. It was not natural by my definition. It was much looser in terms of a natural wine definition. And so I was given kind of carte blanche to gut it and rebuild it in my image. And same with the cocktails and the spirits. And really just made it intrinsically personal on every level. And the program there, I'm still very proud of. Technically speaking, I still am actually the general manager and beverage director there. I'm not there for service anymore, but I still do all the scheduling, all the purchasing, all the payroll, et cetera.
Yeah, the grease that keeps the wheels turning.
Exactly, yeah. And I've been very, very lucky to have the exact same team there since 2019. I've not lost or had to hire a single person since well before COVID.
Amazing.
Which has been really incredible.
Let's take a quick break, because when I come back, I want to talk about Libertine. I want to talk about the role of bistros in New York. And then I'd love to also hear about the playlist that I'm sure is on point at the restaurant. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
She's got a lot for us. She can't go home too quick. Wolf's hungry, he hasn't eaten all day. Follow her, she's getting away. She knows she's got no time to waste. Duh, she's in the forest. And coming for us. Whoa, she's super. Jack the Prick. Climb up your green candlestick. You're running out, but he's too slick. Jack's got your things, he's robbed your house. But you're too slow and he's gotten out. That giant's got one big bone to pick. And she's in the forest. And she's coming for us. Up in your hill, don't waste your time. No, don't stand still. I'm falling fast. I can't stand up. We're two, but soon we could be one. And mom and dad don't want us home. And Jill, she's stuck inside a hole. And Jack, he's really down on his luck. And
welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're chatting with Cody Pruitt, beverage director and managing partner at Libertine. So you stacked all this experience running restaurants. You've had this idea for your own bistro. How did you turn that idea into the ultimate reality? And how did you never give up on your vision? Because it's not only did you have it for years, but then you also had to probably sit on it during the pandemic as well. How did you stay true to what you wanted to do?
For me, I mean, I'm obnoxiously stubborn.
That helps. Yep.
I think you can, some people call it passion, some people call it stubbornness. I think it's a healthy blend of the two, or an unhealthy blend of the two. For me, I mean, I had even done pop-up dinners for what became Libertine on Sunday nights at my first restaurant at Harding's when we were closed. And I sold tickets to that and got a little bit of buzz for that. And I learned a lot from other partners, from colleagues, and from working in the industry. And I knew that it would make sense. And I think the Swedish side of me came out in terms of loving the spreadsheet side and the organizational side and the
very
pragmatic
too.
And realistic and feasibility test-oriented side of it. So I knew it was going to work, and I knew that owning my spot was the next logical spot. I pitched the concept to the Anfora and Lartusi, et cetera, ownership in January of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So about a year and 3 months, even 4 months since I started at Anfora. And I quickly found a space for it, and I started talking to a few people and raising some money. And I went to Paris for R&D, and then the pandemic happened,
right.
And I got COVID and lost my sense of smell and taste for 3.5 months.
Oof.
And as a sommelier and trained cook, bartender, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but in order to keep my mind from, I guess, atrophying and to still be able to exercise my creative side, which has always been an important part for me, which is why I love curating lists and coming up with cocktails and dishes, et cetera. Every single week, I was home for the bulk of it because Anfora didn't really have any to-go options. Mm-hmm. It's not a full kitchen. So for the majority of 3 months of being closed, every week starting on Monday at 10 a.m., I would wake up, shower, and sit at my desk. And I would go online and find an old or new real estate listing for a potential commercial space, whether it be in New York or Miami or L.A. or Richmond, Virginia, or even Paris, London, Reykjavik, somewhere. And I would try to come up with and think of this fictitious restaurant or bar that would work there or other hospitality business, and spend the entire week doing feasibility analyses, coming up with sample menus, even branding for them, writing like short business plan, light kind of preparations. And then on weekends, I used my little stimulus checks to like buy a new Warwick bass and like record some stuff just for fun and just try to be as creative as and as productive, even if it was in a hypothetical scenario, as I could, knowing full well that once the pandemic was over, if it ever ended, which to me felt like it might never have, knowing that Libertine, or what became Libertine, would be my first one. Then I started looking at spaces for Libertine once we reemerged, and I had to run service at Anfora and the various different myriad ways that service was being run in restaurants and bars in New York City post-COVID. So I started looking at spaces, and it was kind of the Wild West, and people were snatching spaces up for really good deals. And I ended up looking at, over the next 10 months or 9 months, I looked at 63 different spaces in downtown Manhattan. And where we are at Libertine now is the 63rd space, or was the 63rd space.
Stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember during COVID, like about a month in April, I got a text from the landlord of the space I had an agreement on, but not a lease signed. And he said, "So are we moving forward with this lease?" And my response was, "Are you fucking joking?" like, take a look outside, man. People are banging pots and pans once a day. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm not doing anything.
That's not anything. Yeah.
But while I was looking at spaces, because I was able to work service at Anfora and make new friends with new regulars who were excited for Anfora's program that we were rebuilding, because I kind of had to gut our entire wine cellar to sell it all off to make sure that we had enough money for rent and payroll. So I was able to remake it all over again, like the second time, and cultivate new regulars and new excited people who were maybe new to the neighborhood, who got COVID deals, who had never been able to live in the West Village before. And those, a lot of those people ended up being investors and partners and supporters of mine in what is now Libertine. I first saw the space in mid-April of 2021. It was still operational as a neighborhood-centric, but it was pretty crappy. Dive, kind of red sauce Italian dive bar / restaurant. Most of the food was frozen. It was kind of grimy. But it was there for 18 years. And it was a corner in the West Village.
Neighborhood spot, man. They stay forever.
Yeah, I never thought I'd be able to afford on a rent or raise basis to a corner spot. I had been previously kind of looking at inline spaces.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I thought that's what I could afford. And I thought I was going to do maybe 24 seats because that's what I could afford. And that's what my lack of confidence in myself at this point, because COVID had definitely shaken that. Sure. I was like, I know it'll work, but I don't know if I can put more than 48 people in there a night. I don't know if more than 48 people per night will come. And then I ended up finding the Libertine space and knowing that there was a little bit more space to fill. And my backers and my partners felt very confident in it, and I grew in confidence. And I designed the place myself. We signed the lease in August of 2021. The previous tenant was given several more months to wrap up business. And so they got out mid-January. The landlords, who are amazing, I really lucked out with phenomenal humans as landlords, which is not something that many people can say. They were immensely helpful at lowering certain costs for me because they did work, and they had a lot of know-how that I didn't offer their developers, and I'm not. I pour wine for a living. but I mean, we built it from the ground up. We replumbed the entire place. We redid the entire electrical. We demoed everything. One of the two cellars was dug down about 7 feet into the subfloor and then rebuilt with new foundation.
Wow.
I designed the bar from scratch using my very rudimentary YouTube gained AutoCAD skills. It worked. We bootstrapped it, and very proud of it now. I ended up finding my now chef and partner through that process. My girlfriend, who's also a partner in the business, so she was working at Pastis. She ended up working at Franchette with a dear friend of mine, who's a dear friend of hers as well. And then they both moved up to La Roque to open La Roque.
So good.
And Isabella was private dining, PDR bookings, and maitre d' and manager there. And then her friend, who had moved from Franchette, who brought her on initially, she was assistant general manager. On the night of, and I'm building out Libertine at this point in 2022. And the night of the La Roque 3-star New York Times review party at La Roque, we're all up there. We're very drunk. and I'm hanging out with the AGM, Karen's, the AGM at the time, Karen. I'm hanging out with her husband, Max, who had been a very, very close friend of mine. Who was the wine director of Roberta's nationwide at the time. He was preparing to open Jupiter up there for the woman who owned King as the wine director there. And he drunkenly asked me, how's it going with the chef hunt and how's it going with construction? I said, construction's going great. Chef hunt is going garbage. And then he said, well, what about me? And I totally forgotten that in a former life, he was a chef.
Not just any chef.
A very talented one. Yeah. He opened his first restaurant when he was 25, like I did. Yeah. He opened his in Burlington, Vermont, called Peace Stew. 2 months after they opened, they were James Beard semifinalists for best new restaurant in the country.
Wild.
He went on to work at Relay in Copenhagen, and Rose's Luxury in D.C., and Texas French Bread in Austin, and Daedalus back in Vermont, and then out in San Francisco. He was hired by Dustin Wilson, had this amazing pedigree as a chef, and essentially wasn't able to find partner, a front of house partner, so he could be a chef. And we kind of were kindred spirits, and we were already very close at that point. We were going to Wu's Wonton King probably three
Top
times.
Five, all month. Time.
Absolutely. All time. I mean, Max still lives there as much as he can.
Shout out to Derek and the team over there.
Absolutely. They are the best.
So let me ask you a question. So you meet your chef, you have the space, you built it out, but the French bistro, I mean, French food has always been a staple of New York City in the dining scene from like the more classical stuff in the last few years. You've seen more of these bistros growing in popular genre. How did you guys set out to define yourself as something unique? Obviously, you put a lot of yourself into it, but what was your approach? What's the music you're playing? Yeah. Like, how did you create this package that obviously – resonated with people from the moment you opened the doors?
I mean, it had developed in my head for a long time. There were certain dishes that I knew were non-negotiables that I wanted. And as soon as I mentioned them to Max, he would pull up on his phone a photo of nearly the exact same dish that he had done at Peace Stew or somewhere else or at home. I don't think he's actually ever even seen the business plan with my sample menus. but he drew up a sample menu, including several of the things and preparations that I had really been insistent and passionate about. And he took it and ran with it. For me, it was important that we weren't like more cutting edge, more bistronomy style. I didn't want to do that as much as I love Septime and Chateaubriand, all those amazing places. We wanted to do something that was a little bit more strong in terms of a point of reference, but Paul be Bear. Creative within that paradigm. I found, and I'm, once again, very stubborn and passionate about this kind of stuff, that when I grew up and we were spending all this time in these small towns in France, there was usually only one bistro in this town. Yeah. And never, ever, ever served French fries. And if you asked for a burger, you'd be laughed out of the room.
Sure.
If you mentioned avocado, they would laugh you out of the room. If you mentioned pasta, even though there's a little bit of French history with pasta, but not really much, and it's kind of negligible. And all Italian-based in its origin. There was no pasta. There was no bolognese. There's no pomodoro or even the word for that. And And for me, like, even when I was younger, coming back to New York, you'd walk into a French bistro or alleged French bistro or brasserie. Most people don't know the difference between those terms or cafes or whatever. They're very distinct definitions in French culture. You walk in and they have Le Burger and Le Pastas and a bunch of stuff that I love eating all that food, but I just found it like it didn't belong. And my history as a mix engineer really taught me to be as much of an editor as possible. Like,
sure,
if it's not adding, then it is taking away, very much like the Coco Chanel, like look at yourself in the mirror before you leave and take one item off.
Yeah.
Like for me, I'm not a minimalist. I much more prefer to focus on what is strongest and then ignore everything else. And I found that even in like-minded wine program French restaurants here in the city, they still ended up doing pastas, or they ended up having multiple steaks on the menu, or a lot of places were essentially a diner with a Pepe Le Pew accent, or a steakhouse for someone who saw the Edith Piaf movie. And yet they call themselves French through and through. And there's no real correlation to that in terms of reality in France, especially within the bistro paradigm, which I find very specific. Like bistros are inherently neighborhood restaurants, and they are almost always very rustic in their preparations. They are hyper-seasonal by definition, hyper-local by definition. Saying a farm-to-table bistro makes no sense to an actual person who understands what a bistro really is, in my opinion. Right. Obviously, people are allowed to have their own interpretations, but
it's more reflection of the neighborhood.
Yeah, I found the inclusion of distinctly non-French or non-bistro dishes to take away from the American or New York understanding of what a bistro is and could be. So for us, it was equally important to define ourselves by what we weren't and what we weren't serving, or what music we weren't playing, than as what we were playing or what we were serving. I never wanted to play Edith Piaf. I love Edith Piaf,
sure,
but it's a caricature. It makes no sense. It's a trope.
Right.
And for us, if you look at the bistros that we love in Paris, they've been bistros with different owners, maybe the same family, for 100 years, 50 years, 70 years, 200 years even. And then the younger generation takes it over and does a little bit of lipstick on something, maybe a new bar top, maybe new art on the walls, maybe new bottles on the list. And it's a modern day bistro in Paris is not modern. It's just so happens to exist in this time.
I mean, it's just interesting because I feel like the bistro, because from where we're sitting in the States to look in New York, it would be like if people like, this is, you know, I'm coming to Brooklyn, I'm going to go eat at Kellogg's Diner because of its 100-year-old history. And people are like, really? Like Kellogg's? I mean, no disrespect. And I'm excited to see what happens when it reopens. But for some reason, the bistro has been elevated and has more of a staying power. And I can count maybe on my hand one or two spots that have opened diners in Paris or things like that. But it's that neighborhood, it's that comfort, it's that nostalgia, it's that, like, I'm, to your point, like, if it's edited well, presented well, I know what I'm going to get, and it's exactly what I want when going there.
Yeah, and by kind of eschewing a lot of these more commonly thought of as French dishes, like escargot, steak frites, et cetera, we can still surprise people. People come in and they go, what do you mean you don't have fries? Like, the only red meat we have in the building is served raw in our tartare. We don't have a steak.
Yeah.
We don't use frozen frog's legs. Like, we don't have any frog's legs. Like, for us, we really wanted to highlight kind of forgotten regional dishes or do modern-day spins on, like, our au poivre is with duck. That kind of thing would allow us enough comfort and recognizability to get people in the door. And then when they see the menu and they see our offerings and our presentation of them, they go, oh, well, this is fresh, but it also feels like I'm in Paris.
Yeah.
And it being fresh is because what's in Paris anyhow.
Like, yeah.
Paris does not exist in a vacuum. Like time exists just as much there as it does here. So what I've always done with when I'm consulting or with other, with opening my own bars or restaurants is kind of come up with a fictitious or a historical person, this would be the person that goes there, and they're kind of like a spirit animal or your flag bearer for the concept through and through. And for me, like, I didn't want it to be this faux cigarette stained place, but I did want it to feel like it kind of, maybe the space saw better days in the 70s. So I immediately thought of Serge Gainsbourg. Also because the name Libertine tends to lend itself to a little bit more of like, maybe like a, on the deviant side of it all.
I love it. I mean, we should always have a deviant side, a place to go to in New York City.
Absolutely. So well, now we have a poster of Serge Gainsbourg. We have Gainsbourg on the playlist very predominantly. We have Bardot on the playlist and Birkin and Gall. And then and that. So essentially, we jumping into the playlist conversation, for me, I wanted it to be time specific. So essentially, nothing really post 1985.
Sure.
Not because we wanted to be a time capsule, but I didn't want anything that people could sing along with.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want anything that I call it the John Bon Jovi effect. Like if someone hears that, like someone's going to hum along to it and then takes them out of their meal.
Yeah.
And I'll leave that to the dive bars. so for us, we wanted to find, I went down a deep rabbit hole of all these French, usually one hit wonders or even specialists in the 50s, 60s and 70s. Who just did American or French covers of American pop songs. So like a French authentic from the 70s version of House of the Rising Sun.
Oh, yes.
Or even like French covers of Beach Boy songs or Elvis songs. Or like even like a cover of Sheena Easton Morning Train, like, which I think is one of the most ingenious covers ever. I think the French translation for that cover is Love is Like a Cigarette.
So like familiar but foreign songs in some ways.
Exactly. Like, and
I know
and
it.
Parallels our food is being like familiar yet new-ish or new enough to stay exciting or to keep you on your toes. Amazing. Still within the overall French existence.
Yeah.
No,
it's amazing. Well, Cody, congratulations. I mean, out like a rocket from the day it opened stores and excited to see where you guys go in the first year. If people want to visit or try and snag a table or just see what you guys have on the chalkboard menu, where can they go? How can they follow along?
You can follow us at Libertine NYC. That's our Instagram handle. You can follow me at Cody C. Pruitt. And our menus are only posted in person, so you got to come visit us. In order to visit us, the bar is first come, first serve, like every good neighborhood spot or bistro is. But due to our size, we do have to have the table's pretty much all reserved out. So go on Resi. They come on 30 days in advance at 7 a.m. Go on Notify if you don't have seen availability. People use it.
The Notify thing, what a hack. I just recently started using it. It's amazing.
It's incredible. I think about 40% of our diners every night are resulting from Notify because so many people book 30 days out and then they cancel 2 weeks in.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing to for people to be able to use as a resource for a small restaurant.
It's amazing. Well, listen, congrats to you and Max and the partners. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Kind of phony atmosphere. It's so hard.
Champion Chills joining us. Jimmy, as we're asking everybody during these times, how are you?
I'm honestly, I'm doing well. As they, you know, I think there are a lot of people that are worse off than I am, and I think they have the floor. So I have no complaints. I'm trying as much as I can to stay engaged and listen to voices I trust and follow their direction and try to be as active as possible. So,
as an artist during these times, what role do you feel art has to help navigate and help people understand?
I think the role of artists in that way is somewhat fixed, in that we always are meant to kind of parse and interpret or filter our experiences and turn that into something that might resonate with others' experiences. I think specifically for me and people kind of in my world or milieu, especially white artists who operate in genres that were innovated and still kind of like run by Black artists in terms of the creative energy and inspiration, which I would say is also all of the genres that might even come to mind. Yeah, basically, like, you know, 20th century harmony was redefined by Black artists, and any genre since, you know, then it shares in that debt to me, whether it's, you know, Willie Nelson records with jazz chords. You know, sure, they're country music, but like, I don't know. I think there are more similarities and more kind of that cultural indebtedness or sense of, you know, we'll just say borrowing freely, sometimes in ways that are hostile and sometimes that are not. But I mean, for me, I'm kind of trying to just listen and talk to people I know, listen to people I know, and learn and kind of assume I know nothing, be good at being wrong, be okay with being wrong, find out which of my assumptions are just my privilege. And, you know, I think as an artist, it's a research time for me. It's not a talking time. It's not a time for like, I mean, you know, I started off making rap music and I'm a white guy. Like, it's not my time to you know, it's listening time. But that being said, you don't want disengagement. I want to still continue to remain receptive and whatever the gate that of experience that kind of comes in my way, that I turn around later after contemplation or after things kind of simmer for a while and turn that into music. I want to keep the receptors on and all the way up. And in conversations, I want to be just a participant in terms of trying to facilitate other people's voices if I can. But ultimately, it's just about getting out of the way and, you know, letting people speak.
We first met when you were doing Brother Reed. You actually played at a party I did, it seems like a million lifetime ago.
At least 1 million.
At least 1 million lifetimes ago. When you laid down the Brother Reed persona and picked up Champion Chills, what did you feel that you could or could not articulate in your previous incarnation that your new incarnation could help you with? Or what direction did you feel you need to go in to adopt a new persona?
It was almost, well, Brother Reed wasn't really a persona as much as it was a collaboration. It was like, it was confusing because we're a group named after my actual Brother Reed. But there were two of us. It was Aaron Garcia, this like really powerful visual artist and also like one of my favorite record producers to this day. And so like that was the group. And I always have felt, even now, like I call my project my group because like fake names are hard for me. Like, they sit weird on me, you know? But the persona of that group was the persona of our times at that time. So we were kind of like very young kids living in like a punk house in LA, being just throwing all of our creative energy at the wall from sun up to sundown, just like every waking moment. And so Brother Reed kind of was the nexus of that for me, but it also, like, you saw those two people on stage, but behind them there was like 20 kind of like wild punk kids who were like, you know, clogging up our bathroom with the screen printing operation and whatever, just, you know, those times were just extremely wild and fun and rebellious and exciting. I think in LA, the energy in the air, it was an era that almost is like missed. It hasn't been named quite, but a lot of crazy stuff came out of then. So what was the air I was breathing for Brother Reed was different. It was way more charged. It was a lot less contemplative. It was like party time, right? It'd be like footprints on the ceiling kind of energy. And then when I started Champion Chills, it was actually a response to, so I went from Brother Reed to basically doing a lot of work behind the scenes and doing some like top line songwriting, what people would call like ghost writing for some artists. I got to work. I did some stuff for some pretty cool artists, but the people that I wound up getting to work with was the real prize in that. So I like spent a couple years under the wing of Sia, and she was kind of my songwriting mentor, and it was really awesome. I learned a ton. And then I just hit this point where I was enjoying the behind the scenes work, but I almost didn't have my like why. Like I was out of touch with the inspiration. It had become not necessarily a job, but like an exercise that I was doing. And so Champion Chills was kind of about moving out of my comfort zone. I started building a modular synthesizer, sometimes from, you know, parts, and sometimes just, you know, putting together different modules from different people. And so I just like, I didn't do anything like that before. Aaron did all the production. So Champion Chills was about me being like, I'm going to make a synth and I'm going to make a record. And the project was really parallel. I was like, I want the point of the record is to kind of like force myself to learn how to make a record with this new tool as I kind of make the tool at the same time. And then the lyrics actually became, I was less attached to the process of that than I ever was. So I just would wake up and write like it was like me doing my calisthenics or brushing my teeth, you know. It would just be like, oh, well, this is yoga today. We're going to sit down and write 3 pages of rhyming verse, and we'll make a patch with the synthesizer and we'll add some drums and then we'll record it. And then the first record I did is basically literally that. Like there was no vision going in. I just like wanted to reinvent myself in a way. I like really got into being the like superpower of being like, okay, being bad at something. So like I didn't know what I was doing, and that really drove the creative process more than, you know, the years where I was kind of like being, you know, held in this kind of expert regard lyrically by people that are just like my musical idols. And that was like a crazy experience, but I almost wanted to get back to that kind of naivety that I just fell in love with in the first place in terms of like making music. It's like, instead of being like the craziest guitar player, you're like, how does this thing work? And you're like stumbling through and figuring it out. And then that creates the output. So for Champion Chills, it was just literally me trying to reconnect with my original, I mean, naivety, right? Like just the power of not knowing and learning as you go, and the almost like the dopamine response that comes from like, last week I couldn't even play this song that I had written, and this week it's under my fingers. So
can we hear a song?
Sure. Let's do a song.
What are you going to play for us first?
First, I want to do just a short one that it's kind of untitled, but it's, so a lot of the project also just went straight to Instagram. And so I just do these little 1 minute vignette-y kind of things. So this is like a pretty good intro to that. But right. Given the world right now, and given the way that there's so many, I mean, there's just so much division in general. I'm today going to play stuff on the guitar because it feels as immediate to me as a music making process as there is. So So great. If we can.
So here we are with Champion Chills, Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Acetaminophen, weed and cinnamon, make a warm compress. And hold on, I played a chord wrong. This is going to happen, but. Acetaminophen, weed and cinnamon, make a warm compress and breathe the lemon in. Men and women, friends, brothers, sisters, lovers, too much under the covers. I just see myself and others. Intoxicating late nights, illuminating mornings. I wake up wearing all the same dreams that I was born in. I draw a bath for Matthew, lukewarm the water zone. Peter sprawled across the lawn and Paul is on the John. Father, don't forgive me because I do know what I do. If you don't know who the mark is, guess what? The mark is you. My brother's still not speaking and it isn't just to me. It's hard to tell how palpable unspoken trust can be. I'm more afraid to fly than I ever was to die. He's got arrows in his sparrow. He's got marrow in his eyes. Count my sorrows on one finger, because one finger's all it takes to turn a second on the trigger to your very last mistake. Do they owe us a living? Of course they do. Of course they do. They owe us a living. Of course they do. Of course they do. They owe us a living. Of course they do. Of course they do. They owe us a living. Of course they fucking do.
One of your lyrics, and if I might quote in reference to New York, is moved here for love, but stayed for the snacks. What snacks did you stay in New York for, and what do you miss right now?
Oh, man. I mean, there's no start or stop to this conversation, but I'm going to just think, because I've been out of my neighborhood for a little while. I just want to think in terms of geographically. But there's some classics I would be remiss not to mention, but the first thing that comes to mind is like what Dennis Snow is doing at D&D. It's like had immediately became my favorite place right when it kind of started. I think they're like, there's so much creativity going into that place. I mean, I don't even know what I'd even call out from there. I mean, the fun is amazing, but I also feel like the last couple times I went in there, they bring out like different variations of stuff. The rice paper salad that feels like it. There's like a, I don't know. There's a lot of snacks there. I also, the in my neighborhood, Suzume is a place that I think is kind of a slept on thing. Do you know that place?
I don't.
It's hard to describe. When I went in there, it seemed like there was, early on, they had a lot of, I mean, they have a lot of dishes that I understand to be like Hawaiian dishes, like a spam musubi and stuff like that. But then they have some ramens that I really enjoy too. I don't know. I can't not talk about Little Frankie's. Specifically their like charred grilled eggplant thing is my favorite food in the world. Yeah. I mean, there's lots. I think that lyric was in reference to New York Noodle Town with the duck soup that they have.
Oh, the great NY Noodle Town. You know, yeah. I drove by it during the pandemic in the hopes that maybe it would be open, that I was like, I'm going to risk this. Like, I don't, you know, like early days. And it was so shuttered up on like 11 o'clock on a Tuesday. And oh, it was, man. So sad.
Oh man. It's, I mean, that's, yeah, this is actually not even to laugh. It's like a, you know, solemn time for that industry in that city, which is like, I mean, I'm willing to, you know, argue with anybody that it could trade with any food city in the world, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was sent for my birthday from Terrence Tay. He sent me like a whole, the TT, the man behind every scenes. But he sent me a bagel setup from Barney Greengrass that was insane. It was like everything from like, you know, a dozen of their bagels, whitefish salad, There's some smoked sturgeon, this like salmon pastrami, and then he must really like me because he sent me a little pot of the caviar from there too.
Ooh,
yeah.
Darren, the other co-host of the show, contends that like a Barney Greengrass setup or a Ross and Daughters setup, like, is always the perfect gift, no matter the situation. Like, you could send that in any situation, any occurrence, and everyone's going to be like, "That was perfect."
I was completely impressed. I mean, I had to have, you know, it was a big birthday for me this year, and I was, you know, I had it in isolation, and it was the first thing that happened, and I was like, "It's all downhill from here. We're sure. We're like, this is as good as it would have been if we were all wherever in the desert celebrating." You know, I cried. I definitely teared up. It was. I can confirm that at least for my birthday this year, it was the perfect gift. I can't really see a time when I wouldn't open that box and not have that smile. So,
can we hear another song?
Sure. Yes. Why not? I love songs. Let me think which one I want to do. I'm going to play this song that's called California. That's about California. California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush. I know a man who walks in my neighborhood. He made beautiful songs, but he never sold much, sold much. Came too long after the gold rush. Then he fell in with people you don't trust. Now he can't pay for his own lunch. But I don't judge, don't judge. At the cafe where I practice my Spanish, she asked me if I had an acne can manage. My mom's name is Janice. She's not why I'm manic. I'm good with a secret. I'm not naming names. But give me 10 minutes and things may have changed. California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush. Hand gripping the wheel on the freeway, young enough to sell, old enough to repay. Last minute flight was a couple hundred each way. I got a memory that's starring you, I need to replay. I heard you got a new main thing. I heard he shuffles, but he can't swing. The kind of guy to wear shorts to a funeral. But I'ma stay composed like a movie cue. Under the surface, I'm batshit bananas. All last minute chances and flashes of panic. Don't judge. Don't judge. Not too often I say what I really want much, but California, California, thank you for your cloying aromas, your beautiful views, arroyos and lomas, who wants to wake up from so lovely a coma after the gold rush, after the gold rush.
I know that you have a finished EP, but you are holding off on it right now. Mm-hmm. As a artist and a creative, you know, who doesn't really have too many options to either share work or perform, what are you thinking about this extended time off and how it relates to your creative process?
A lot of my decisions about kind of releases lately I've been heavily evaluating just kind of what do you want to get out of music making in general? What's my motivation? I think it's like, is that time in my life? I think it's a time you like really, you know, you're just like, I'm pretty aware of the time that I've got, but I've still got a ton of it. But I also like, I mean, a lot of, a lot of people are in a lot of worse spots to just be like holding back with their immediate plans that were either output related or financial or something like that. So for me, I picked up the guitar just a couple years ago. And so that for me is like the thing I'm working on right now to kind of grow myself. And so my musical practice has kind of become a different entity than my, like, what, how you might track my career or whatever, like my release schedule or that kind of thing. So letting them be separate has actually been really freeing. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm staying busy and writing almost in a way that is quasi-therapeutic, but I also think about it more as like conditioning or exploration or research. But that's ongoing, and that's, I just am kind of, yeah, I mean, I've got a, I'm writing all the time and collecting songs and recording and stuff, but I just, right now, yeah, you, I think the decks need to be cleared right now for really important messages, because this is a extremely pivotal time, and we do need music in times like this. But this record is a highly personal record that just does not address or fit in currently to this landscape. But it's here. I'm going to share it. You know, I will share it. I think we've all got to kind of galvanize and get behind a real big sweeping systemic change like we've never really seen, certainly in our lifetimes. But I also think we have to stay engaged and stay active. So while I might not be trying to like share or clog people's feed with my observations, because my political observations I'm not the one with the perspective that is basically as rooted in reality as it can be. And my kind of, the further afield we get from what we might have called politics or justice, you know, my observational work isn't necessarily like going to save anybody's life just yet. So I want to keep that practice open just to stay very human. But in terms of like putting it out as a commodity, those are just kind of two different things. And this way it kind of lets me roam a little more freely and without any of the pressures or even like, presumptions on my behalf that might get in my way of like telling the truth.
The evolution of a practice in anyone's career is super interesting because different things motivate us and different things push us forward. How do you determine the new skill that you want to add to it? How does that enter into your world?
I think the best way to know what you want is, I mean, you can't do something really hard. And I mean that like throw yourself at something or do something really difficult, kind of in both senses, without desire, you know, like you'll kind of know when, you know, when I have a dear friend who actually is, honestly, he's my guitar teacher. He's probably be mad at me for saying this because he doesn't present as like a guitar person or a music person, but he does all this other stuff. He has this like awesome like Instagram channel with his mom, and he's like an amazing photographer and a director, but he also does needlepoint, and like he does it really well, and he's clearly logged some hours, and I'm just like, I could not just wake up and force myself to get good at needlepoint. But this person is, Kevin Hayes is my friend, but you know, he got struck by the desire to be really good at needlepoint and then applied whoever he was to that. And then now there's this, you know, there's all this stuff that he's made, or he did the cover for like a Dawes record. He's like done a bunch of stuff with needlepoint now. And I'm just like, I don't know how you dream up that's your idea to do with your net with however many hours of the one life we presumably have. I don't know. I found out about modular. I kind of literally, you know, for pun intended, was switched on by my friend Dave Grant, who he's an experimental New York City musician originally from Richmond. But he kind of showed me this, and I was like, oh, wow, for my purposes, this is a whole different tool. I'm going to go down this path. And it was just fun. And then now it's like a fun thing I have in my life. And then with the guitar, I saw John Bryan play a show maybe like 5 years ago for the first time, which is my fault. My life would have been better if I'd seen him 20 years ago or whatever, which I totally could have, but I just slept. I saw him play and I was like, oh my God, like whatever he's doing with harmony, whatever he's doing with like capital M music, this is important. And I need to do what I can to like learn this language so I can even just hear what he's doing, not even so I can play what I'm doing, you know? So I had this like hot, heavy, like conversion experience. I was like house sitting for a friend in LA. I went home from that show at Largo. It was like one of his monthly shows at Largo. And then I just like stayed up all night. I wrote like 8 or 9 kind of verse pieces that night, and the sun came up and I just kind of like passed out on the couch. And then I was like, I need to know about this. So I started on the piano, and then I wound up at my parents' house for a month in North Carolina because I don't remember why I was down there, but I think somebody was kind of needing some help in a health way. But they didn't have a piano because people don't always have pianos, but there's always kind of a guitar. So I was just like, oh, yeah, you can do this and like whatever, sit in front of Netflix, be quiet. As long as you don't bother the people that are also watching TV, or you can like practice all the time. So the accessibility of that makes with like this come to Jesus experience I had at this John Bryan concert, just like drove me to practice every minute I could for the whole, for the next 5 years, basically. Like I'm not where I'm going, but I've definitely put a lot of time in and I love it. And it feels good to me. It doesn't feel like work. So, I mean, I can kind of, I'm not very good at making myself do things I don't want to do, but I am very good at just throwing my whole self at something once it's kind of given me that itch. So I would just say it's about being receptive, like knowing when that has happened and then running towards it. And then hopefully you get lucky and these obsessions are healthy ones. Whether it's like, obviously stuff like cycling or reading or writing or is healthier than just being like, oh, I'm super obsessed with this one kind of wasabi potato chip, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, but I can only eat so many before I would get sick.
All right. Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song, but cool. Where can people find you, hear your records, follow along, et cetera?
I am on Instagram as Champion Chills. That's one word, but the word champion and the word chills together with no spaces. And then that's my project name across every platform, Spotify, iTunes, anywhere that there's kind of like distributed to streaming, you can find me. And I just put out a single earlier this year. I'm probably going to do an EP by the end of this year, hopefully. And yeah, come say hello. I usually share kind of sketches of my process on the Instagram, and then the more cooked work you can find in those stores. So
amazing. Well, we want to thank chef and educator Kevin Mitchell for joining us earlier in the show. And thanks for tuning in to Snacky Tunes. We'll be back with more coverage of the coronavirus and the creation and education around it. What's the name of the song you're going to play for us?
This song I'm going to play is a version of a song that I just actually finished 2 weeks ago, and it's called The Chords Prayer.
Amazing. Thank you for listening this week. Jimmy, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes.
Don't get me wrong, I look like a pawn, but we hit the conflicts, then it gets on. I'm sweet as a yam, but please, if it's hands, then your whole corner starts ripping in gauze. We don't take breathers away for applause. Don't like to spend weekends away from my dogs. A scandalous age, we're handling things like fuck it, we're ripping the bandages off. I am a monster up from a bog, a gently recovering bump on a log. I am a kick that goes bumping tonight, the subtlest itch when something ain't right. And
I don't know how y'all been feeling lately, but I feel amazing. I've been this crazy. My synesthesia's been really seeping in. Who needs reason when even breathing is a chore and everything is becoming a store? It is a luxury just to be bored. It is an honor to me to be yours. Play the Lord. Praise the court. Our mother who art in heaven, you taught us all how to save ourselves. Give me strength. Bless my weapon. Deliver the tyrant straight to hell. I am not without my flaws, but keeping you safe is my only cause. Sorry, but things have been pushing my buttons lately, and not one of those buttons is pause. Saint ambiguity, you are not new to me. Please don't be naive, child. Don't assume continuity. Experience fluidly. Address tyranny truthfully. You are the chosen one. Your ascension is soon to be. Only then can we move at ease like two leaves in a cool breeze. They say that pride leaves us open to falls, but I felt so good I ain't noticed it all. You are my home, but with open walls. Oh, to be known, to be so involved. I mean evolved. I mean enthralled. Don't hide who you are. I need it all. I am a shield. So much worse for the wear. But I could be healed if I perched in your hair. So many sins, so little time. I would commit every one with you if you agreed to be mine. Lust, gluttony, sloth, wrath, envy, pride, or greed. I already have everything that I want, but you might be all that you are all that I need. You're all that I need. You're all that I need.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.